What's up, everyone? Hopefully, you enjoy this episode. I am talking to the buyer of one of my businesses that I just recently sold. I thought it'd be interesting for y'all to hear both sides of buying and selling a business and what each side learned. If you haven't given me 5 stars on whatever you're listening to, Apple, Spotify, whatever, do it. That's how I feed my children. And also, I'm starting something in the next couple of weeks that I think a lot of y'all will enjoy. It's going to be a special Facebook group for people that are serious about starting, scaling, and selling side hustles. It is going to be called Start, Scale, Sell, appropriately named. So keep your eye out for that. Look for it on LinkedIn or Twitter or Facebook. And I think a lot of y'all will enjoy it. I'm excited for it. Hope you enjoy.
Cool. Sounds good.
Boom. We're live. Luke, what's up, dude? So tell everyone like one story, 1 minute like background on what you do now and like in 60 seconds, how you kind of came to do that.
Sounds good. Yeah, thanks for having me on, Raleigh. So I guess quickest background on me is that I started Linear about 6 years ago as somewhat of a side hustle. It wasn't like a primary focus point for me.
What was your primary during while you were doing that?
So I had a phone repair company that I was
Oh,
working
got
on
it. Yeah.
building, doing like cell phone repair out of retail locations here in Utah.
Yeah. And so you were running a retail store that you ended up selling out of, right?
Yeah.
So what did, so how do you go from, was it just Linear had momentum and you're like, this is really what I want to do. This clicks a lot better than cell phone repair. Or how did you get to the point where you're at now, where you're no longer in cell phone repair and you're kind of full-time Linear?
Yeah, it's actually a pretty crazy story. So the first company that I was with, you know, there was kind of some falling out actually with some of the partners,
Yeah.
and I ended up going and working with another company. So I actually left the original company, went to another one, and kind of acquired some equity in a different company. So it wasn't even the first company that I started with. So I went to essentially the biggest rival. It's a crazy story if I really get into the details, but basically switched companies about halfway through the journey, and then kind of saw that company through to a point where I realized that I think the other ownership also realized that it was going to take a lot more firepower, a lot more money in the bank than maybe what we had
Yeah.
to grow the company where it needed to be.
Because you're trying to go grow corporate stores, and every corporate store you got to do a build out, sign a lease, and get a whole staff in place.
Yeah, I mean, one of the reasons, there's a lot of things that you don't think of in any industry, right? I mean, so something like in technology like that, there's so many things that can change, and one of them is supply. So, you know, if you're depending on Apple parts or Samsung parts for your service and they change their price, and then you have to change the price on the consumer, or maybe, you know, you're paying more for those parts than you used to.
Yeah.
There's a lot of things that kind of come into play, but eventually, for me personally, it was a lot of it was I kind of something you said earlier when we were just chatting is I looked at the opportunity with Linear and I kind of evaluated where I was spending my time and how much value I was getting out of that time. And
Right.
I felt like the value I was getting out of the time spent at Linear was much more profitable to me than the time I was getting out of the cell phone repair chain. So it kind of ended up being that transfer of time.
And so how did the exit transaction end up happening? Were you trying to push the other partners along, like, hey guys, like, let's get out of this thing? Or did a different company just kind of fall out of the sky and like, we'll take you guys out? How did that happen?
Yeah, so I left. It's kind of, I guess, sad for me. I left about a year early before a bigger company came along and actually acquired. So I just was bought out by the existing
Oh, they bought you out.
ownership. Yeah.
Got it.
And then, you know, not long after that, a bigger company came in and bought the entire business out. And so, you know, in hindsight, I think, hey, maybe I should have waited on that, a little bit impatient. But that's kind of how it went down.
Yeah. I mean, a similar thing happened on Alcatraz. Like, obviously, 6 months before y'all bought Alcatraz, I bought one of my partners out, and like, he obviously took a lower valuation than what I ended up selling for, but like, he also avoided a ton of crap, you know, like just even like take coronavirus to the side, right? Like, he avoided just a whole bunch of shit involved with like transitioning out of a business that me and you have gone back and forth on like for weeks and weeks and weeks, and bankers and like all this bull crap that we like, I look back and yeah, he got out for, you know, whatever, 60 cents on the dollar of what I eventually got out for, but like, it like wouldn't have been the worst, you know, it wasn't the worst deal in the world for him to get out the way that he did, you know?
Yeah. No, and I'm sure the same is true. You know, that's interesting. And I didn't even think about that. And so that's an interesting perspective that you bring to the table there too.
Yeah. It's just like so simple to be like, whatever, whether it's seller financing, like it's just so clean to be like, the first thing that I've learned, and you probably, you've experienced this, is like, I don't think I'll ever start a business again where there's not buy sell provisions, you know, where basically once all the partnership doesn't agree on what's going to happen, a lot of times you'll have a clause in an operating agreement that's like, we set how we're going to value the business. And if me and you are in a partnership and it's like, hey dude, like I'm out, like I'll sell at a $600,000 value. I think the business is worth 600 grand. And you say buy or sell, you either buy me out at 600 or sell at 600. And like, that I think solves so much partnership issues that like when you're just starting a business, you're like, this is the dream. We're going to do this shit for the rest of our lives. And we're going to go public and like, this is all going to work. And then like 3 years later, especially on brick and mortar and like hard to scale businesses where like, whatever, a partner has a kid and like, they don't want to keep the freaking pedal to the metal on like grinding, right? That's like, you get a bunch of just partnership differences and like how do you want to grow it? Like, I want this to be a $1 billion thing versus like, and I'm willing to die for it versus like, like $1 million a year is great, you know, and like how you deal with all that crap, you know?
No, 100%. And I think like another thing when you say, you know, you're looking at buy sell provisions is something you pay a ton of attention to going into a new business. And this is a lot less technical, but I think for me, early on, because, you know, I think I've been through three or four ventures at this point with, yeah, with partners of one kind or another. And I look at my early decisions and it was in a lot of ways, I was buying a job. I was paying to have a job, right? I was putting some money out. I was investing and then it was also this huge time investment where I was basically buying a 9-to-5 or a, you know, a 9-to-9 job, depending on the situation. And so that's kind of weird. And I think I see a lot of people do that where they see, you know, their friend has a business or, you know, maybe it's even like their dad's business and they see some opportunity, some value they can add, but they come in with money and they also bring their time and they put themselves, you know, where really they've bought themselves a job, right? Which now looking back, like, and especially after Alcatraz, I would never buy another job again. I mean, that's right. That kind of goes against that's not a good investment in my personal opinion.
Yeah. Yeah. And your Alcatraz structure is different than that, right? Like the time, right, that you bring in, you get compensated for it. And it's like, it's
minimal.
Oh, so you still feel like this will be the last deal where you kind of fell into it one last time of like, oh, I still am bringing, do you feel like you got trapped into that one last time and are now recognizing it, or?
No, not at all. So, I mean, I set up Alcatraz actually perfect. So this was the first deal that I've done where I'd really set it up right. So I guess more than anything, it's like my time investment was specified as like part of when I came into the deal. That was one of the first things that I was very clear about, is like, you know, basically I'm going to be a board member. I'm going to provide X number of hours maximum per month, and I'm going to be compensated for those hours.
Yeah.
And I think when you come into an agreement with that, and I even had like a compensation structure written out for, I think, the first 2 years for my hourly rate. And then everything else I do, I outsource to, you know, other companies that I own or am, you know, that I know the owner. So I do very little work, which is actually a good thing. I'm a delegator. Really, I'm not the best employee when it comes down to that.
Yeah.
So that's what I've done with Alcatraz is I my time involvement is minimal, and you know, the payout structure for the amount of time that I put into it is well worth it.
Yeah. No, that's and so now that you've kind of run the gamut of selling a business, buying a business, and starting a business, what are your thoughts in terms of your preference on, you know, the risk reward from buying a pre-existing thing versus starting your own thing versus, I guess, selling your own thing? You have to do one of those two things first, but starting versus buying, because something that I think about, right, as I'm kind of like moving things off of my plate and then very much in sell phase of getting out of everything. And I look at the process that y'all went through and the capital that you brought to the table to take me out, and how safe that capital is, and you know, buying something. I'm kind of like my personal, like where I'm at right now after going through the transaction is like, unless I'm doing a D2C business that I can start for less than 10 grand, like if I'm putting more than like 50 to 100 grand in a business, like I'd rather take that 100, lever it at 90%, get an SBA loan, and buy a business that's doing 7 figures a year in revenue. That's like already jump the chasm of like the risk and like the whatever 85% fail rate. Like that seems like so much better of an idea to me outside of like, unless I'm starting a really small Shopify store or like a personal brand that's like going to pay off for the next 25 years. And then real estate's kind of off to the side as its own little analysis, but that's where I'm at. How do you think about it? I guess you have a business that you're still in the scale phase of, right? You have a scale business and then you have an acquired business, but your scale business is one that you started.
Yeah. Well, I mean, we're basically on the same line of thought when it comes to, you know, starting versus buying versus, selling. I mean, when it comes to selling, that's obvious. If you've got the, you know, you've either purchased a business already or you started it and you have the opportunity to sell and it makes sense for whatever reason, whether that's monetary or maybe just, you know, you have another passion you want to pursue, then, you know, selling, I mean, like you've experienced and I've experienced, there's some stress behind it. There's a lot of paperwork. There's a lot of negotiation, a lot of back and forth. But when it comes to starting a business, that's an undertaking that I think most people, if they knew how hard it was going to be, probably would go back in time and not do it. Especially when you look at the money, like I look at the money that I put into startups, and you're right, you can put a crazy amount of money in and look at it a couple of years later and go, okay, what could I have bought coming in with that kind of capital? What could I have leveraged? And you said something, I guess the only good reason to start a business is you had a post on LinkedIn, I think a couple days ago, maybe a week ago, where you talked about following your passion and kind of finding your passion. And I think that's the only real reason that I would recommend someone start a business is if you have something that you're like, hey, I want to do this for the rest of my life. I'm super passionate about it. Maybe you believe you can scale it to the point where you can actually change the world with it, right? Or it's something that you really feel like you can, you know, you can go hard for 10, 20 years, because that might be what it takes.
Yeah.
It's going to take a lot of grit. You're going to, you know, it's going to be hard. And if you feel super passionate about it, I think that passion or that obsession can push you through it and you can make it with starting your own business.
Yeah.
But no, I feel the same way as you do. If you don't have that kind of passion, and you're just looking at something and you say, oh, I, you know, I've heard you can make a lot of money doing this. I'm thinking about starting a business doing this because you can make money doing it. Might not be the best use of your capital. Cause I don't think that the money comes as quickly or as easily as a lot of people would hope it would.
Right.
And I think you can put a lot of money and a lot of time into a business. You can end up leveraged. You have a lot of problems starting your own business. So yeah, I mean, that's kind of my train of thought.
Yeah, no, I think, for whatever reason, I think buying a business is like, I think it's a very under, when you look at the people that want to go into business for themselves, at least from my experience personally, like buying a business wasn't part of like the analysis, you know what I mean? And I think it will be from now on. Like if I were to go back in 2016, when I was practicing law and I was like, I freaking hate this. I can't do this anymore. Right. And I saw the Market Watch article that I saw. That's like the unbelievably lucrative business of escape rooms. Right. The next thing that I would do now, having gone through this process, would be, I would go on Biz Buy Sell and say, what are escape rooms trading for? Let me look at some P&L. Let me see if I can buy an escape room business. Right. First, yeah. Like, and if you can't buy an escape room business for like a reasonable amount of money buy a good escape room business, then maybe go to the next stage of the analysis of like, okay, well, let's look at starting one and what that looks like. The problem is that stage of like, let's look at starting one and what that looks like. I think it would be hard. You would be hard pressed to find a better, the people that started Alcatraz, right? Me, a lawyer, my brother was a banker at Goldman Sachs and our other partner was a CPA at KPMG, right? Like that should be like a team that like could analyze and forecast what a business will look like.
Yeah.
And like, we were so insanely wrong about everything. You know, yeah, what I mean? Like we thought that we could build it for 200 grand. We spent 700 grand, you know, like everything was just like wrong, like flat out wrong. And it was a business that already existed. Like we could go into physical escape rooms and be like, let's see, like, what do we think this file cabinet costs? Let's look, like, you know, like we were like itemizing stuff. And we were still just so wrong forecasting. And like, you look at pitches for like new businesses and they're so wrong. Yeah. Like you're so much safer looking at a P&L and even P&Ls with sellers, right? You can hide stuff and you can like keep things on the DL and put it in different categories and whatever.
Sure.
But I think, again, looking at what y'all ended up buying and the position that you're in for the capital that you put in,
it's pretty crazy.
So much better off, right? So much better off. And obviously Corona like helped that probably juice that by another 30%, you know what I mean? Which, and from my side, it's like a perfect, like, I hope it crushes it. Like I have no, like, not like, oh, those guys stuck me. You know what I mean? Like, I think it ended up, what are some things that you were surprised by or learned, like going through the buy process, like some things as you go through a buy process again, after having gone through it with us. And obviously you were kind of a little bit more on the background and you're kind of operating partner that was doing a lot of the heavy lifting, but were the things that kind of surprised you, took you for return on the buy side?
Yeah, for sure. But if I can, I want to bounce back really quick. I want to come back to that because there's something, if you're cool with that.
Yeah. Yeah, bro.
So you said, you were talking about the value and if I can, you said if you're comfortable with numbers, you mentioned you spent like 700 grand to build it.
Yeah.
But my question is so how long before we came in, how long was Alcatraz in existence kind of from startup to
June of 2016? So,
okay, so 4 years roughly.
Yeah.
Okay. So over those 4 years, I mean, how much do you think you spent in real money kind of getting it to where it is now? If you had to
an actual cash out the door?
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah, I think 700. I mean, that's time. That's not including time.
Yeah.
You know, that's me. That's us three partners that all come from $200,000 a year jobs, right? That's us three working for free. Yeah, I think we spent like 700 grand in like between building out that Draper store. And I mean, I know Linden costs 250. And then Draper costs like 500 just in like build all in. Yeah.
Yeah. And so are you cool with me saying kind of some of the numbers and stuff as far as acquisition
goes? Yeah, bro. Okay. I'm great.
So I look at it and it's like, okay, we came in and we paid about 1.5, right? Yeah. Give or take. But that's obviously, that's a lot of that's leveraged, right? And so when it comes to real money down, you know, we're only looking at less than 200,000 in money out of our pockets.
Yeah.
And so I think that just that example right there should represent to people who are thinking about starting a business versus purchasing one. You're talking about 4 years of, I'm guessing, some long days and a lot of headaches and a lot of money.
Freaking 10,000 hours. Yeah.
Yeah. And I mean, right now it's been, like, I mean, not every way, I don't think every acquisition is going to be this way, but it hasn't been hard for me. It's been basically money in the door and that's it. You know, and now I'm getting paid. I have a pretty defined job. We're making, you know, progress, and it was instantly a good investment. And, you know, I think COVID fueled some of that, but even without COVID, it was a good investment.
Yeah.
And so I think that, like, people should weigh that right there. That's a, what is that? So 200 versus less than 200 versus 750. So that's like, what, a fifth? Yeah,
and the other part of that from the sell side, I don't, when most people are starting a business, right? The economics of Alcatraz to me, my economics from the very beginning, probably 50% of what I ultimately took home personally off of Alcatraz, 50% of it was tied up in the exit. You know what I mean? So like when I look at it, when we looked at the prospect of keeping it and kind of milking it and, you know, riding out the coronavirus wave and dealing with whatever 5 or 10 hours a week of dealing with just issues come up that are, when you're running a $1 million plus a year business, I think it's just impossible for it to just run without you, without, you know, you can't just leave it and say, where's my check? Cause there's too much intricacy happening. But when I looked at it, even knowing, you know, if I look at it, if I start counting your money and say, man, these guys are getting way too good of a deal, like screw these guys, right? Trying to take my baby away from me. If I start looking at your deal and I start getting upset about that, like from the economics to me was like, this is the best case scenario. My best case scenario is this is probably what I'm going to make. If Alcatraz does everything that it's supposed to do, this is my next 3 years of payments that I'm getting in one day, right? 3 years in one day. And then I'm completely unlocked from Alcatraz. And I have complete confidence that I can take the liquidity from Alcatraz in a post-coronavirus world and deploy that differently. You know what I mean? And there were other partners in the deal that didn't, that, you know, I think that's important that when you're in a transaction, you have to underwrite, you can't start looking at what the deal looks like for somebody else because you get messed up, right? And you start analyzing it incorrectly. And you end up walking from good deals and staying in bad deals, you know, because you're not paying attention to what it looks like for you. Because if I had started to play hardball and say, you know, screw you guys, like this is too good of a deal for y'all, right? I'm jacking up the price another 15% because y'all can't have this good of a deal on my back. There just wouldn't have been a deal, right? Yeah. And we went through some, I think that the interesting thing from the sell side of the deal was, I think that all in all, like we probably got, I would give buyer seller probably like a B to a B plus, like a decent job of like creating win-wins and like being reasonable and not raking each other through the coals. You know what I mean? And that ends up being real important because I think the thing that I didn't understand when I sold is like how it's kind of like a sticky booger that you just can't freaking get off your feet. Like you still, you know, there's just transition stuff that's still happening, you know, 6 weeks after it's done. and had all really dicked me over on key points of the deal, you know, I'm under no contractual obligation to like, you know, help. I could just be like, screw you guys. Like,
yeah, that's true.
Oh, you need this like thing transition. Like, screw it. That's not my problem. And I think it was the thing that I don't think I realized before is that even if you're in a more predatory position on a transaction, you have to give the seller or the buyer, you have to make them feel like that you can't just strong arm people, right? Yeah. Because once it gets zero sum, and you have to start with like, I trust these guys, and like, yeah, these guys, like, even though we're on opposite ends, like, I don't think I'll ever buy a business where I'm looking at the seller and I'm just like, this looks like a really good business, but I just don't trust you. Like, there's just too much that can happen that can be like hidden that it's just like not worth it.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, the first time meeting you guys was a huge turning point for me, because, you know, I wasn't, as you know, I wasn't the one who originally found the listing and went after. I was kind of brought in,
yeah,
as a partner to the deal. But yeah, I mean, meeting you guys was huge, because I think there was instantly some trust and rapport that I felt between you and Bentley. So that kind of, you know, I think building a relationship with, you know, buyer or seller, no matter what side of the deal you're on, is super important. Because like you said, there's a lot of things that have to happen after the deal. And in our case, some things that would have made a pretty big impact if they hadn't happened. So we had to have some trust in you guys to make sure that the deal was going to go the way that we planned. And so, I think that goes back to looking at being bought out before an actual acquisition, like I did. And like, I think you had said you had someone at Alcatraz who you bought out,
yep,
earlier. That's another thing they don't have to deal with, is that post-sell transition. And the work that goes into that. So those are the pros and cons, if you will.
And so, as you were going through the buy process, what are like your takeaways, like as you go through a transaction on round two, that you're like, next time this was really critical, I'm glad that this happened, or like, next time I'm going to do this differently than the way that it happened in Alcatraz?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think probably first thing that comes to mind is investigating like company processes a little bit.
Yeah.
That's really hard to see from, you know, financials are super important in any business. Obviously, those are some key indicators, right? But when you're buying a business, and you're looking for a business that's going to pretty much run itself in a lot of ways, you're looking at it from an investor standpoint, I think looking at taking a deeper dive into operations and processes is something
that operations and processes suck ass.
I mean, you know, they're actually, it's not like there's anything subpar there.
It's tribal. It's all like, hire okay people and kind of let them, because, I mean, we, right, it was pretty passive for us, like for the 14 months prior to us selling it, right? Like I wasn't involved, and like for the first 2 years, it was always like I was in there and like, no, this is how you're a zombie moderator. Like, this is how you do that, you know? And like, and then once it got to a certain level,
I can't even picture you doing that.
It was like, it was my livelihood, bro. Like, it was like my only way out, you know? But then I'm like, oh wait, like whether they're a C moderator, whether I spend 20 hours on this high school kid to make them a perfect zombie moderator.
Yeah.
Like, I'm getting a return on time now. And I didn't, the proper business step is, let me document it. Let me shoot some videos of me teaching this. And every person who goes through it, right, they need to go through this training process that I pre-recorded. That's the right way to do it. That's just not what I did, you know? But anyway, keep going.
Yeah, no, I think that's one of them for sure. But, you know, looking at that, and it's not so much of something that you look at and you decide, hey, their processes aren't perfect, so this isn't going to be the right move for me.
Right.
But I think it's something that you look at so that you can see if there's opportunity there. Because if you find a business that has opportunity to have better processes, then that might be a big reason you actually do choose to buy it, because you look at what they're doing and you go, hey, we can make this a lot better. That's one of the areas we can improve. Yeah. And I think the same thing goes for, you know, if you're looking at their marketing or their advertising, you know, how well are they promoting themselves? You know, it depends on the business and what you're looking at, but there's areas that you shouldn't necessarily discount, right? Like you look at it and you go, okay, well, if this isn't perfect, I'm not going to buy it. That might be the wrong way to look at it if you have the knowledge and expertise to improve those things.
Yeah.
But I think it's also how much time you want to spend on that business. So that's why I would say look, you know, a little closer at those things to determine how well it runs itself. But one of the things that I would also, I think would have been good that we didn't do a lot of was, you know, investigating the culture. And I think we got pretty lucky because there's an awesome culture at Alcatraz. And the employees and the team really get along. They vibe well with each other. And there's definitely a type of person that works there that wants to work there. Yeah. And that's awesome. That's what you need. But I think that's super important. And that's something that I didn't really think of until after. And I was sitting in that first team party we had and kind of watching everybody interact. And I was like, oh, okay, they all get along, you know. That's a relief. Like, I mean, because you never know. Like, you know, you could end up with a company where half of the people hate management. You know, that's a very real possibility. And I've seen that in actually in other companies that I've been involved in where there's not good culture. There's, you know, a very unhealthy culture. And I've left, you know, that's why people leave companies. And so when you're acquiring a company like Alcatraz, that's a service, in a lot of ways, a service-based business. I mean, you have the rooms, but you need people to run the rooms.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I think any business where people are an asset, you've got to investigate the people. And see how solid they are. I guess one of the things I think we did well is we kept on management and we made sure from day one, you know, we were like, hey, who are the managers? And we met with them right away. And then we kind of spoiled them a little bit to make sure they stayed on because, you know, we wanted to make sure that, hey, if they're a key part of the company and these are the people that are responsible for running the business, we don't want to lose them day one.
Right. Yeah, culture is really interesting because it is such a key. I think culture is a really hard one because it's so key to the business that you buy, especially, like you said, service-based. But from a sell side, it's also like culture's, you know, culture, I think, is one of the easier ones to like, kind of like, hey, let's keep this swept under the rug. Like, you know, because as a seller, you're trying to keep your best foot for, like, you know, there's not like, hey, bro, let me tell you all of the worst things about this business, just so you know, just full transparency.
Yeah.
Like, let me tell you that, like, you have to, like, jiggle the handle three times here. Like, it's not fixed. Like, you haven't fixed this handle. It's going to cost you $50 for a locksmith. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
You're trying to keep your best foot forward and keeping really tight conversation. Like, you know, most of the talks that y'all had with our employees before we sold, you don't want the employees to feel super disrupted just in case the transaction doesn't happen.
True.
Right. Yeah. You don't want the employees to feel like ownership is like bailing. Right. And then your buyer walks on you. And so most of our conversations were like supervised. Like we were all as a group setting, making sure that, you know, no one's saying something that's misinterpreted. So yeah, I don't know the best, I'm just thinking how you go, like the best way to go about analyzing that. Like in Draper, I think looking for it, like if you were looking for the clues for it, you could see like, oh, they have a photo wall of like all their employees, like birthdays. And like, that's like a good indicator of culture. Outside of something like that, that like shows like, you could probably look at like how often they do company outings and that kind of thing. But yeah, I think that's an interesting one that I wouldn't think of when I'm underwriting a business is like, does everybody like each other? But, yeah, Alcatraz ends up having probably one of the better cultures of like all of the like locations that we have.
That's awesome. Yeah, and I think, you knowing James, the partner, you can kind of see where he's a great fit for that scene, coming from the entertainment industry. He actually had, an escape room business before coming into it.
Right.
And so I think that's the other thing to think about in the buying process is, exactly what is your position going to be at this business? And make sure that that's super defined too. So like with James coming from the operations side and knowing, how to run escape rooms, being in the entertainment business and being a more operational guy, he has his focus, whereas I have a pretty clear focus on marketing and the growth side of things that I'm not going to be involved in the day-to-day. I'm not going to be expected to do certain things out of my element, and make sure there's opportunities for your skill set to fit into that acquisition, if that makes sense. I mean, and so specifically, I guess that, when I look at that, it's like, is everybody coming into the deal a good culture fit? Or can you vibe with the culture that already exists? And can you bring something to the table that's maybe one of the business's weak points? Because if you are acquiring a business, I mean, the goal has to be to grow that business, right? Because you're going to have more overhead, unless it's a cash deal and you've got 1.5 sitting in your account, and you're, your instant cash flow on it, you're going to have a loan payment. And so if you're going to have a loan payment, then you can't just buy a business and keep it as is and expect the same margin of return.
Yeah.
So I think that's one thing that I did learn is, and that you don't think about as much going in, is it's like, oh, we're going to have a pretty sizable chunk of our revenue going out in a loan payment.
Right.
And we put those projections together, but it's a lot more real when you look at those numbers after the fact and you realize, hey, we've got to grow by, let's say, 15% or 20% just to be where the previous owners were before the acquisition. So I think that's important to take that into account.
Was there a time in the transaction where you kind of where you got cold feet and you were just like, I'm just out? And what do you think that was at that moment? And which I think now you would say, like what would you go back and tell that person? Because I've, like, when I bought my first, like, house, like the night before, I'm like, shit, I got to bail. Like, I don't care if I lose my earnest money. Like, I'm out. Like, I just can't do it. Like, this is like a bad decision. Right. And I think that's like so normal. And I'm interested, like, how your feeling is telling you, like, legit the wrong thing. That's like, it's just wrong.
Oh, yeah.
And how you'll think about that on the next go around.
Yeah, 100%. So there was a point where it wasn't long after I'd actually gone and made those first few deposits of money. And I remember I made the deposit at the bank. And as I was leaving the bank, my buddy called me. He's like, man, like, this is crazy. Did you hear what's going on? And I'm kind of like, well, I don't know what he's talking about. Like, he's like, dude, they're like talking about shutting down the whole country for coronavirus. And I'm like, what? Like, this isn't real, And I was a huge skeptic, without getting into politics and everything too much. Yeah. Like, basically, I was just a huge skeptic. Like, I'm a generally a pretty healthy person, so I wasn't too concerned about it. Like, I'd heard about it, but I didn't think it was going to be as big as people were saying. And literally, right as, I had put my money in the account, I'd signed the on the dotted line, for that down payment. That's when we, basically we heard, hey, we're probably going to be quarantining people. And so immediately, like, I had that fear set in where I was like, I just bought a business that puts people in tiny little rooms in groups of 10. This was a terrible investment. Like, what was I thinking, And so, there's a little panic that kind of set in. And I got to say, like, just hats off to my, to James. I mean, he's a calm guy.
Yeah.
And I think that is one of the advantages of buying a business with a partner. If you have the right partner, you're able to kind of, bounce those fears off of each other. And I think what was good to see is we kind of experienced that same fear. But we were able to kind of talk it out and we were like, hey, we've got time. We have, X number of days before,
right,
we're going to be out of our earnest money. We have some time. Let's wait and see what happens. And that was pretty much how the rest of the process went. We were like, okay, you know, 30 days later. And then we're like, okay, where are we at? Yeah. Should we back out of this deal? And then we're like, I don't know, let's wait another 30 days. Let's see what happens. And so we basically just waited it out. And like things in life often do, the situation for, you know, most of it worked itself out. Not that coronavirus is over, but that, you know, there was a lot of government assistance and programs that came in that made the deal worth doing. As well as, you know, I think we were just very candid with you as well. We came back to the table and said, hey, here's our fears. Like, we don't, what's going on? What do you guys think? And we had a lot of laughs actually in that conversation. That definitely happened. That's a real thing. I think that's a unique situation to 2020. I hope that this is the only time I can say that happened in a business deal. But yeah.
So as you this deal done, what are some of the things that think are interesting? So the game is, assume you're at a job right now. What do you think you start, like, what are your action steps? Like, to go from job working, from cell phone, did you have a job before that?
Yeah.
Do you like take like a job?
I sold alarms door to door.
Oh, hell yeah. You're a sales guy. So what do you do? If you have a job, like a 9-to-5 job, with your, what are some areas that you think are interesting?
Yeah. So I'll answer that with a quick story from my past, blast from the past a little bit, because I think it makes sense. So actually, when I'd come back from selling alarms, I know a lot of guys just kind of take the rest of the year off, but that wasn't really me. I wanted to keep working. So I went to, because it's a summer program, or at least it was when I did it. It was, you know, back in 2012. You went out for 3-4 months, and then you were off basically the rest of the year. And I came back, and I decided to sell cars because I wanted to be making money. I wanted to be doing something. And I remember being on the lot for about a month, and this is when I had wanted to start Linear. And I turned to my buddy who had gone out and done alarms with me, and he was selling cars with me at the time, and I was like, yeah, I'm gonna quit today. And he's like, looking at me like, what? Dude, you just had the best month of any rep, like, on the sales floor. What are you talking about? You're not gonna quit, like, you're an idiot, you know? I'm like, no, I'm gonna go start my own company. And he's looking at me like, no way, dude. And, you know, I went and put in my 2 weeks. All the management was like, oh yeah, Luke, okay, yeah, we'll see you in a month or two, man. Have fun starting your own business. You know, like, totally didn't believe me. You know, I was also only I was 21 at the time.
Yeah.
22. So they probably had good reason to doubt, you know.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think that it, you know, the first thing though that was important is that I had some savings. Right. I had some money from alarms. I had some, you know, some money put away. So if you're working a job, you know, you're doing your 9-to-5 grind. I mean, before you can, and I think you probably, I would imagine you'd agree with this, before you can make any investment, first you got to have some savings. You have some money put away.
Yeah. Yeah, you can't be a capitalist without capital.
Yeah, exactly. You've got to have something to bring to the table, you know, unless you're doing your own Shopify store, your own e-commerce thing. Which I think brings me to the second, you know, half of your question. What do I find, you know, interesting, or what opportunities, arenas do I see out there that are, you know, have a lot of opportunity right now? And I think that this is, you have to be a little careful with anything that's too easy and only takes sweat equity. Because when it only takes sweat equity, there's going to be a lot of people doing it. So whether that's a Shopify store, or an agency, or, any kind of personal, like, professional service, or very, very cheap, you know, level barrier of entry type companies, you're going to face a lot of competition. And competition is going to, you know, drive your prices down. It's not to say that you can't succeed at it. It's just, I think it's going to be you might be disappointed at your return or the amount of money you make or how long it takes you to make money doing those type of things. I think the one area that interests me most is actually like educational or content-based jobs or investments, if you will. So this is something that I'm delving into a little bit right now myself. If you've built expertise in anything at your job, so let's say that you're a marketing major and you've been the chief marketing officer at a company, maybe you're pulling in 150 a year or 200 a year, and you're a specialist at marketing, then you have a skill that very few people do, and you've specialized in it. I think that's when you can start to monetize your knowledge, and that's a sweat equity investment or job company that you can start that's not going to face as much competition or as much scrutiny, because you're really just selling your own expertise. You're selling your knowledge and you're selling your ability to help other people. And you're going to get paid, I think, according to the value you bring to the table. And I think more people could do that if they were investing in creating content. Yeah. And that's where the investment side comes from. Is a lot of people think, well, because I'm selling my knowledge, or because I'm selling this, this sweat equity, this service, I don't need to invest in marketing myself. I don't need to invest in building content. And that's just really not true. I mean, like to throw out a number, for one of my companies right now, we spend like 11 grand a month just building content. So I would say, it's a pretty sizable amount. I mean, there's companies that spend way more than that without a doubt. So that's probably, that's more of the floor than it is the ceiling. But it should show people that, like, if you're going to create good content and you're going to, actually build your own brand, it's going to take an investment aside from just your time at some point.
No, I agree. I think the problem that the first problem that people run into is they're scared to put themselves out there and their ideas out there, right? Yeah. But that part's scary. Then the next problem is they maybe have good ideas and they have problems that they want to solve, but you can't get there just on just sheer force of will and quality of content. You have to get distribution, and you got to pay for distribution. And at that point you have to have we were talking about this yesterday when we were talking about my podcast and all that stuff. The question is, well, what problem, how do you want to solve the problem? And people are going to pay you to get their problem solved. Unless you're an entertainer and you're not doing, information stuff, you're doing, entertainment stuff, but you have to be like funny or hot, I guess, or super ripped. I guess you could do that. That's what you should pivot to. Is you just be like a bodybuilder guy.
Instagram endorsements, man. That's where it's at these days.
Yeah. So is the thing that's interesting to you is using Linear to help people with their personal brands? Is that the move? Or you want to do that yourself on your own personal brand?
So, neither. I'll spill the beans a little bit.
Tell me, bro.
Yeah, I'll tell you.
You heard it here first.
Yeah, so we, along the kind of the journey with Linear, we've worked with a lot of different medical companies, specifically chiropractors. And so when you work with a niche like that, what starts to happen when you're building content, when you're building content and you're building like content for a specific niche, you start to get a bunch of leads, right? But like most leads are, I mean, there's more minnows than there are whales in the sea, right? So a lot of the leads we get at Linear are really too small for us to actually work with them, right? So it's like, a chiropractor who it's just him and his assistant, right? And their revenue's less than 50 grand a month. Like, they're not going to probably be a good client or a good customer for us. But because of the content we built, we're getting them to fill out our form and we're getting these leads. And so I'm sitting here going, how can I monetize that, right? One way is I can start selling a course on how they can do what we do themselves until they get bigger.
Right.
And then if they like the course, then obviously they're going to upsell and eventually they're going to sign up with, you know, Linear at some point, right?
Yeah.
But beyond that, I've made some connections in that realm with chiropractors that I work with, and we've kind of found a missing piece that a lot of chiropractors are missing. And through that kind of missing piece, we've been able to see an opportunity to create a course that's going to help a lot of people grow and take their practices to the next level. And so we're working on, you know, putting that next piece together, and we already kind of have the leads from a roundabout way. So
right.
We've already built the audience, and now we can come back to the audience with something that's going to bring them value, as opposed to building something and then trying to find the audience.
And then, so
that's a lot. Like, it's something that I wouldn't have thought of going into this. Like, I didn't start building the content and see this opportunity. I started, you know, building the content, didn't know if it was honestly even going to work.
Right.
Like, it took over a year before we even really started getting traction. And so that was like, I compare it to like working out and going to the gym. Like, if you go and work out once and you eat healthy for one day, like, you're not going to look in the mirror and have a six pack.
Right.
But I think with business, for some reason, people go, okay, I wrote a blog, I published it. Where are my leads?
Yeah.
You know, hey, me and Raleigh put up this video the other day. Where are my LinkedIn connections? Where are my endorsements? What's going on? I started a YouTube channel. I posted one video. Where's my money from YouTube?
I posted four YouTube videos and I'm not big yet, so I quit.
Exactly. But like anything, there's this element of consistency.
Consistency.
It's so underrated.
Yeah.
Like, you know, we were spending probably $4,000 a month to begin with on articles, and I was spending hours and hours myself writing them. And my employees were writing them, like, we were editing
right.
them, and they weren't even that good. Like, they're a yeah. lot better now, but we were doing it, and we were doing it consistently every single week, and it took us a year before we even saw results. So it's the same kind of principle. Like, if you're going to build an audience, that's, I think, the key. Once you build an audience, it's a lot easier to see opportunities than it is to find, like, oh, I think this might work. You spend all this money and time building something, and then you go and try to find an audience for it. I mean, that's going to cost you a lot more.
Yeah. No, I hate product focused. I'm much more like the pragmatist of, like, I'll take legit distribution over legit products almost any, like, in every segment. Like, I'll take a million person email list over, like, the $1 million, like, the product that's been designed and stuff. I start with distribution, and then I work backwards to, like, what that distribution channel wants to see. And so much of it is the opposite, where they get an idea of a product that they want that solves a need that they have. And they say that this is what I want to spend the rest of my life doing, you know, and it's tough. I mean, both of them are tough, but when you have distribution, it's a lot easier.
Yeah. And I think with distribution, a lot of people look at an audience they have, and they're like, oh, it's too specific, or it's too small, or the reverse of that is they look at their idea or the product they have and they think, oh, this is too small, it's too niche. But I think the opposite is oftentimes true. Like, the ideas that are way more broad and they're suited to everyone, I see those flop a lot more than the things that are very specific. Hopefully that kind of tied to, you know, your question. I mean, basically the thing that interests me most right now is, you know, that information, that you have, the knowledge you have, and kind of putting that out there, much like you are right now, building your audience. And then after you've built your audience, then you can focus on solving their problems.
Yeah, no, I completely. And like, when I talk to professionals, most professionals that I talk to are people that are wanting to start a side hustle. So you can either start a physical product business or you can start an information business. I say information business because, again, kind of wiggling around what you're saying, that you can't really do information without, you know, paying for distribution. You can at least start on information.
You can.
Oh, with most people, they're not even starting on anything, right? Like, they just don't do, like, it's like, I want to get out of my job. What's on Netflix tonight? it's like the end of the loop, you know what I mean? Until Monday. Monday, it's like, I want to get out of my job. I forgot, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So like the first step is like action and information on action. And then the problem that you run into is like, oh, well, I'm not an expert on dick. I don't know anything, right? Yeah. And then you're like, well, like, let's think like, well, what'd you get on your test scores or like whatever, like, you know, something. But I think content is having a content business with my wife on meal plan supplements, meal plans and workout guides. When you get a content business where you're selling information and there's traction on it, like, it makes every other business look so stupid to do. You're like, I'm going to pay rent on something and I'm going to like have cost of goods sold. When I can have 100% margin business outside of just marketing and like record stuff once, and you got to get result, you know, you got to get people results and you have to provide the value. But outside of that, once you get something like that clicks, like, and there are people that hate courses. I know everyone kind of has their own different take on it, but I'm all in on it. I believe in it.
Yeah, I do too. I mean, I paid for expensive courses to build linear. I mean, I probably spent 10 grand or more on courses for myself.
Yeah.
And quite honestly, I'm sure there's shit courses out there, but this is, you know, if you do some research, like, and you find good courses, I've never been disappointed. I mean, look at how expensive it is to go to college, right? I mean, you know, you went to law school. So it's like,
love to spend $10,000 on courses for law school. Tried $250,000, you know?
Right. Yeah. Those are some hefty student loans.
Yeah. And so, I actually think the first step that people once you buy a course and you see what it is, and you feel the value and you're like, oh shit, I would have never, like, it would have taken me forever to connect those dots. And I paid $999, whatever. Like, once you get value out of course, I think there's like this expectation when you start pushing information on somebody, like start an information business. And it feels like a huckster thing, 'cause there is that in the internet. There's like, oh, this doesn't feel right. Like, you should be trying to monetize information. It should be free and egalitarian, whatever. Once you buy a course and like somebody presents you with like organized ideas that help you through your problem, you're like, I would pay 10x for what I paid for this. You know what I mean? And I think that's probably the thing that I need to like change and have people do, is like, you need to do information, but you need to go buy information first so you can just see what it feels like. And like, you get a good value exchange out of getting information that actually helps you get unstuck. Like, it's so worth what you pay for it. Like, the people that I know that are pro information from a business standpoint are the people that have consumed it and have gotten a lot of value in it. And once you get value, it's like, yeah, there's nothing like shady about it. You know what I mean? It's like, it's legit. It helps people.
Oh yeah. I'm 100%. And it's funny because people are quick to, you know, say, oh, I have some money, I want to invest my money, whether that's into starting a business or side hustle or the stock market for that matter. People are really quick to jump on the idea that, you know, they have to put their money to work for them. But what's funny is they'll open a Robinhood account and start buying stocks before they know anything about buying stocks. They won't pay for the course or, you know, hire a mentor to teach them.
They'll lose five grand.
Yeah.
Lose five grand over $1,000 course on how to buy options.
And so they're just, they're just learning by their own mistakes instead of learning from someone else's. And in my experience, it's a lot cheaper to learn from someone else's mistakes than it is, you know, to learn from your own. So, you know, I think that's the most important thing, you know, kind of, I guess the takeaway would be, before you start investing in, you know, a new business idea or, you know, anything, invest in yourself first, make sure you have the knowledge to make a good decision on that investment.
Yeah. No, I love it, dude. Okay, dude. Well, how can people reach out to you? How can they find you? What kind of problems do you like solving for people? LinkedIn, Twitter, what's the best?
Yeah. LinkedIn's good. Twitter's good. First and last name, Luke Heineke, is my tag. Linear is the company. So if you're looking for help with PPC or CRO, and you just, you know, you can always shoot me a line, lineardesign.com. I spend probably way too much time just helping people, pointing them in the right direction. But no, I'm happy to.
You need to make it public, bro. You got to start posting on LinkedIn, man. You know what I mean?
Working on it. I'll give myself a shout out. We've got a course coming out that's going to teach people Google Ads, Facebook Ads, landing page design, CRO, taught by me. So.
And it's going to be on Linear. That's going to be on Linear's website or on website.
Yep, LinearDesign.com. Yep.
Cool. All right, bro. We'll talk soon. Appreciate the time.
All right, peace. Really.